Dormammu, I've come to bargain.
I feel something.
You feel it?
Yes, I feel it.
That's the force.
Do you lay eggs?
What?
No.
Blow that piece of junk out of the sky!
Quite a lot's happened. You and I had a fight recently.
Did I win?
No, I won easily.
I am Groot.
I am Steve Rogers.
Traitor!
Who in the hell do you think you are?
I have spoken.
Hey guys, welcome to WDWNT Nerd Alert. I'm your host, Joe Hogarth, and joining me tonight is Jack McCarthy.
Howdy, folks.
And Fedra Ekris.
Hello, everyone.
So in tonight's show, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be discussing the latest news, and we'll also be going over the latest episode of The Book of Boba Fett. But there's a couple other things we're going to discuss. First, I guess we'll start with Fedra. I know you told me you saw Encanto, right?
I did. And like I usually do when I have a lot to say, I have about probably a page and a half of notes. So I
Oh, yeah. Jack, did you see Encanto yet?
I haven't. I mean, I have enough trying to keep up with the shows that I try to watch. And I still have like a ton of stuff on the DVR.
Well, it's a movie.
Yeah.
And you could say whatever you want, Fedra. You know, don't worry.
Don't worry about spoilers, Jack. On my account.
Oh, okay. I was gonna, you know, wait if we had to. So I guess I'll go with just the rating first. I'm very brutal because even though this had the cuteness of Disney, I did not really feel it at all. There were only very certain segments that I did. So I will still give this 4 to 5 out of 10. I was also not impressed with the music. I think some of it was well done in the wordage, but it's just, you know, and I'm comparing this to classic Disney, you know, music where it was award-winning. So I don't know if they're just lowering the budget and so the music wasn't as important.
You know who did it?
No, I do not. I didn't look it up.
Lin-Manuel Miranda.
It's not ringing a bell.
Really?
Yeah.
He's the guy who did Hamilton.
Oh, okay. Yes, I heard that was a big success. Yeah.
You know, he kind of weasels his way into everything now.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I'm not saying that it wasn't, you know, good to its caliber. It just did not strike me as, you know, other Disney classic songs. So that's just my two cents. Again, take it for what you will. What I will say of the benefit of this film, this really does correlate a lot of issues in families when it's dysfunctional or it's a toxic environment. It actually is really like introducing that in this film, and it touches up on a lot of different topics with everyone in the family. And that I really thought was very interesting. The way that everyone has a gift and everybody's trying to figure out what Mirabelle's gift is. So the most famous in the film is Abuela, which is the grandmother who gets the gift of the candle. Bella is the one who's ultimately perfect. Luisa is the strength. Bruno is the prophet or visionary. And so each of them, you know, showcase different struggles in the film, in the relationship to the grandmother. Mirabelle is feeling unidentified, really not knowing who she is and what she represents in the family just because she doesn't have this gift or something quote unquote special about her. So I really like that they're putting that theme into Disney, but at the same time, you know, it just, again, like I said, certain scenes resonated, but it just felt like it was all pieced together very commercially, not like a genuine, connective story to me. I just felt like there was a space of disconnect to the whole thing. I guess I'll take apart some of the characters. So I know, Joe, you and I discussed about Louisa being like this first, you know, female character that's like buff and tall and like ginormous arms and showcases her strength. So I kind of dissected her song so that I could showcase, no matter the gender, if we just take apart the gender here, because I know a lot of people are fixated on that. Let's just look at the character and what the character symbolizes. So the character symbolizes the strength of being an older brother or an older sister. In this case, it's the older sister. Parts of the song I actually resonated as an older sister, but I think it just goes for anyone that feels like you always have to be the strong one. You always have to be tough. You always have to put on this show of being, you know, always never, you know, making a mistake. Whereas underneath, you're literally suppressing your emotions. You're hiding everything because you don't want anyone to know that you might crack or you might falter or make a mistake. And the expectations of others, especially your family, is what is kind of hovering in this woman, which I thought was very, you know, nice to see and kind of put to the surface here. And even in the song, it's like what's underneath the surface. I thought that was very creative. You know, how she's even saying, like, how do I persevere with what my purpose is? And I have to be, you know, perfect all the time, not only for my family, but all of my siblings are looking at me on what I'm going to do. I mean, that really resonates with a lot of, you know, older brothers and sisters and families. So that was very, you know, I think well done. The most disturbing thing I thought from the family was Bruno. I mean, really? I mean, this whole showcase of this home is filled with magic. We don't know if it's good magic or bad magic. We just,
oh yeah. Now I'm starting to get like why you're so tied to this.
Yeah. I mean, cause there's magic in it. It's like, we don't know if it's good or bad. We just know that it was a miracle. And now, you know, Bruno is like, I mean, I love that they used a salsa song and they're like, you don't talk about Bruno. No, no. Like that was genius. I mean, that's a great hook. I got to say.
Jack would like that song. Cause it's very much like that.
I didn't realize they were like a dysfunctional family the way you're describing it.
Well,
they don't, it sounded like they're all happy they have superpowers and
I wouldn't say they're dysfunctional. Let Frederick continue.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think it's dysfunctional. I mean, one question I would have, Joe, because you saw it, right?
Hmm?
How old do you think Maribel is as the lead character in that? Like from the beginning, like when you see her,
I would say she's probably about 16.
Okay. So Jack, think about this since you haven't seen it. So Bruno has the ability as a prophet and someone that has premonition. I think it's very interesting how Disney puts all this magic. And then the one that has the ability to prophesize is the one that's literally shunned and buried into the walls and hides away for years when his niece is born up until she's 16, when she finds out that he's in the walls hiding from his family, because apparently everything that Bruno sees is negative. So nobody wants to see him. Kind of reminds me of cancel culture in a way, you know, just pointing that out. But it also like shows to me like that's kind of hypocritical. So someone that's really into their third eye and like having all these premonitions and like telling people what is to come, but they're the ones that are shunned in a magical house, like that was really messed up to me. Like I was like literally watching it and I'm like holy, you know what? Like Maribel goes and finds this painting and goes through these walls and then finds out that her uncle has been in isolation.
So they isolate him. He didn't isolate himself.
No, he did isolate himself.
He did isolate himself. because he
because
was
everybody gave him grief all the time.
Yeah, and he like he felt ashamed, and he was put down that, you know, he was not helping the family. So his mother says, so he literally hides, you know, from his family for years. And we know this. We know a lot of people that, I mean, I could speak for myself. You guys could speak, but you know, I know people that have been considered a reject or a misfit or a weirdo, and they're literally outcasted from their family. Some do it out of spite, like, fine, you don't accept me, don't accept me. There's some people that are like, I really want to be accepted and you're not accepting me, so I have to go away. Like, showing that in a Disney movie, I think that was great, but at the same time, it also shows the reality of the dysfunctionality here. And you see that he's pale, he's tired, he's neglected. He even portrays like he's an actor, showcasing multiple personality disorder because probably he's been isolated for years. You know, it was just really a messed up part to see.
You got way much more out of this than I did.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, like, what I think that Maribel, you know, gives as far as her gift is the fact that she showcases this truth. Like, instead of being afraid of her uncle, she's not. She went right to it to figure it out. When he wasn't sure about using his own gift, she literally encourages him. And that shows really the innocence of children, which I thought was really well done here, and showing that you have to believe in yourself. Like, those were awesome themes. And those, I think, is what Disney really is all about. Like, that's what I would love to see more instead of all of this, you know. But anyway, you know, the vision that he has is out of order, and it shows this symbolism of the butterfly, which is the transformation of the house, the transformation of the family. I thought that was really cool. I'm almost done. and, you know, as Maribel points out these flaws, and they're not necessarily flaws, they're just showing that nobody's perfect, not even the perfect Isabel. You know, I really loved that part as well, where Maribel tries to apologize to her sister. She really doesn't want to, but it showcases that, hey, you can't have resentment. You got to let that go. You got to talk it out. And when she talks it out, Isabella realizes that she's not even being real. And so when she finds out that you can create something imperfect, you can make a mistake, that's when even Isabella like awakens herself. So give it to Disney to really show at the end a very messed up situation, which is grandmother's story, where her whole like entire village is being ransacked by these violent people, and like showcasing that by this miracle of her husband sacrificing himself for the whole village. And he dies, of course. Another father that gets killed, Joe, again in Disney. I can't wait to point this out, like, because, you know, it just happens too often. And by this miracle that is, you know, the grandmother's gift. And she really shows, I think, the truest lesson that's very much missed. Maribel points out to her grandmother that she suffered the most. That she lost her home, she lost the husband of, you know, her husband, her partner, and all she had left was her children. And because of that love of the children, she had so much fear that she would lose them. And that's what was destroying the home. So I thought that was really nicely shown, because when you have fear, you want to kind of control everything. And when you control people, you don't really allow them to be them, right? And so I love that at the end, it's showing that family, like true, authentic connection in your family, is the greatest gift of all. So I would say that the ending, as far as the writing, was brilliant, but animation was okay. Music, okay. But I just wanted to point out those very interesting things in a Disney film.
Yeah, you should do a commentary for that movie. Like a commentary track, like what they used to have like for Blu-rays and stuff like that.
Just point out everything. Oh God.
Yeah, because like I got none of that. I mean, basically, if you want Fedra, I wrote the review for the site, so go check it out on wdwnt.com and see what I have to say. It's very similar, but I don't get as technical as you. I gave it a 7 out of 10, but yeah, I didn't like it. But I've confessed to the people that listen to this podcast that I've been given higher ratings because everybody always rags on the fact that I give such low ratings to movies. But yeah, this movie was not very good. It's beautiful to look at. I mean, I think it's stunning. I think that some of the animation is very well done. I think that it's very colorful. Again, the cinematography that they used in this was pretty impressive at times. But when I went into the movie, I thought, is this going to be another Coco? Because you guys have all mm-hmm. seen Coco, right?
Mm-hmm.
Jack, you've seen
Never Coco. Made it through it.
God, this guy.
But is this a Disney animation or is this a Pixar?
No, this is Disney.
Disney.
This is a Disney animation. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I liked Coco, but, you know, my papi from, you know, he grew up in Mexico City. He hated it. He was just like, oh, this is really? Just commercialized, you know, like this ain't real. Like, and I was just like, okay. I thought it had very strong themes that I could see, but... And I mean, I'm also I play guitar and I love guitar. So I love the story behind the song and the guitarist and all that. That was great. But I also like that in this film, everyone looked different. You know, like I liked that to show the diversity in it. And I believe on the side of the village, like it said Colombia. So if it does takes place in Colombia, then there are going to be... different yeah. body shapes and different, you know, skin color and all of that. So I am really, really happy that, you know, not everybody was like a cookie cutter look.
No, I'm glad they did that too, because I didn't know that. I didn't know that everyone had different skin colors in Colombia. I mean, when I think of someone that's Hispanic, I kind of have a kind of view in my mind of what their skin color might look like, but mm-hmm. some of them, you know, were much darker than I would say the other ones. And I thought that was impressive because I had no idea about that. So it's good when people can learn things about that. And I thought that this is a problem, you know, with that movie. Coco was a good story. This one was not. I mean, for me anyway, it had good music. This one didn't have good music. And it had a villain in this one. This one didn't have a villain. And again, that's where Disney and Pixar have been having problems. They just don't like to have villains anymore in their movies because they're too scary or they feel like it's going to affect children in some way. But Coco, again, it was a nice journey. It was a beautiful looking movie. I love the main characters. I loved all the characters in that movie. I'm a really huge fan of that one. I think I gave that at least a 9. And I've seen it multiple times. I've seen it in Spanish. And actually, from you talking about Encanto, I'm going to watch it again. I'm going to go watch it in Spanish this time because I think that helps sometimes when you watch it in what should be the native language and just put subtitles on.
I think that's very true. That's a good point. And I think in this film also, in contrast to Coco did address the grandmother, and it addressed it in a certain way of keeping tradition and showing that, you know, even through the outer world, you know, you should honor your ancestors, you should respect them and speak to them, even though they've passed on. I think that's a beautiful tradition, personally. And in this film, it was more that Meribel had to challenge her grandmother, and she did it still in a very respectful way. So I love how that was also shown, not in the sense that you have to disrespect your elders if you disagree with them. It's more of that you just have to be honest and just stand your ground on things. And there's a way that everyone can come to a resolve. It doesn't always have to be so destructive. So I think that was also another thing that was showcased well, very subtly in this film.
Well, Jack might like it because they are kind of like mutants. They all have like these weird powers. Mm-hmm. Like one is super strong.
Dolores can hear everything. Medibel's mother, she can heal with food, so she makes you like a soup and you're like all good. Like, I love the guy where he has like this disfigured wrist and she like gives him a like little pastry and then he's all fixed. Like, that was great.
but my problem again with this movie is I just don't think kids would latch on to it. It's not one of those movies that you want to see over and over again. And like, once you see it, I can't, like, if a kid has to choose between this and Frozen, I'm going to watch Frozen because that's fun. This one just isn't very fun. And I think the problem with Disney has been doing is that they wanted to push the culture, Colombian culture, and what mm-hmm. it was like. And they accomplished that. But I think that was their first and foremost goal, and to show inclusiveness and all different types of Colombians. They didn't have a story first. And that's where Coco, I think, succeeded, is I think they did have a story. It's like, okay, this is a little boy. You know, he thinks his great grandfather is this great singer and hero of his. It turns out that there's a twist. He's actually the villain, you know, mm-hmm. and it really captured you throughout. This didn't do it. It just felt like there was really not much of a story in this. And I was bored. I just couldn't wait for this movie to end. I kept looking at my watch. And again, I think it's beautiful to look at, but Disney has to realize that story is very important. You know, you just can't paint a lovely picture on the screen. And I will agree, Fedra, Lin-Manuel Miranda, he's just so overrated. I know I don't like him. I don't like a lot of his politics and all that. But I just think that he's too much. He gets too much credit for a lot of crap. I like the song that Maribel had sang it. I thought that was very good, but the rest were like so. They weren't real Disney songs that, you know.
Yes, it did. It did feel very musical, you know, like Broadway. So that's when you said that, I was like, oh, okay, that would make sense. And I agree. I agree with everything you're saying there, because, you know, I feel like you want to resonate with the character's voice, and I feel like there were a lot of duets. So sometimes you're trying to follow, you know, Isabella's part or Maribel's part, and you get lost. I mean, I loved Luisa's. Like, I could totally see a lot of people liking Luisa because it had this like kind of not rap, but like spoken word vibe and some nice beats. And I was like, okay, you're getting some modern stuff in here. All right. Like, I could dig that, you know. But again, like, still the story overall, I did not connect to it. I mean, I probably connected to the most traumatic parts, not just because of like my own personal experiences, but just because of my friends, of just knowing so many like people that, you know, for a time just didn't talk to their family and were like deranged, you know, and like, and you know, just knowing how that feels when you like address a parent or a family member and they like shun you for whatever reason. That's very hard for any age. So, I mean, I guess maybe you would agree that this film is kind of like a preteen or teen kind of Disney movie, not really like kids. Like, I don't see a 7 or 8 year old grasping this or wanting to see this again. Like, I completely agree with that.
I don't think
it's like there's a lot of levels in there that really aren't. I don't know if like sometimes they put things in, some adult themes in to keep mm-hmm. the parents paying attention, but it sounds like there's an awful lot of depth to this, even though there isn't much to it.
Well, Jack, it's me. I mean, I'm a freaking, like,
oh yeah, you pick everything deep. Apart.
Yeah, I do. So please.
There was also like 10 to 12 characters in this movie, and it felt like that was way too much. And it's funny because I was watching Pulp Fiction today.
Nice. And
when you look at Quentin Tarantino, and I'll say Pulp Fiction, I think, is my favorite movie, along with I think it's just like the best written movie, best directed movie. But my most enjoyable movie, I would say, is The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. But those are the two movies that always come out on top for me. But what Quentin Tarantino gets right is he can have a huge cast and he's able to get away with that. But a lot of people, like, again, when we saw The Eternals, The problem is that there was just way too many characters and we just couldn't really grasp on all of them. And I think that that was the problem with Encanto too. You have to be careful. You have to have a director that can get the most out of it. Like, look at friggin'.
You got to line up your scenes.
Like Infinity War. Look how many characters were in there. And they were so evenly balanced. Maybe some had a little bit more, but the Russo brothers did a fantastic job of having so many characters on the screen and not really shortchanging too many characters. And that must have been difficult. And if you can't do that in an animated movie, you shouldn't just do it. Plain and simple. Bottom line is, yeah, I didn't like it. Fair didn't like it. We'll see. Maybe Jack might like it, but I doubt it.
We're getting around.
No, I hope if you can, you know, next week to check it out, Jack, so we can hear your opinion. I mean, I would love to see, do you even see what I'm seeing, you know?
Oh, I have the newest episode of Resident Alien.
Resident Alien?
Oh my God, that's one of the best shows ever. It's on Sci-Fi.
Ever.
I'm serious.
Love you,
I'm serious. This show has like sparked, like,
oh, is that what
things
that,
around our house? Like, it used to be whenever something dramatic happened, we'd always go dun dun dun. Now we've gone chung chung, based on Law and Order due to Resident Alien. I mean, Fedra, after you finish Daredevil, go back.
Oh boy,
and track that down.
Resident Alien. Okay, I'm writing it down. It's part of the notes.
Oh yeah. But I mean, there's so much stuff that I'm trying to catch up on. It's crazy, but I'll put Encanto on the list one time.
Is that that show with Alan Tudyk?
Huh?
Is that the show with Alan Tudyk?
Yes.
Okay.
Who's great? He's usually always fun to watch.
All right. Anyway, I'm going to get into Superman and Lois season 2. Jack had suggested that I watch the first 3 episodes
because he was going off of secondhand information.
Yes, I did.
Instead of watching it himself, he was going off of secondhand information.
Well, I just said
you're also a huge Superman fan, so why would you not check it out?
Yeah, exactly.
I'll tell you why. Because I just got bored of it. The first season, how many episodes in the first season? I think maybe 15. It's weird.
Season.
I stopped at 12, and I never finished, you know, the first season. So I was like, I don't want to watch season 2. But when I did hear some outlandish things that had happened in season 2, I was curious about it. But I just said, yeah, I heard it sucks, and Jack was like, oh no, you need to watch it first before you make a decision. So I did. I watched it, and I do think it sucks.
And as I said, I will let you go on interrupted.
Okay, I'll go and interrupt it. So I'll tell you, Jack. Wait.
Okay, so you say it sucks. What do you rate the first season so far then?
First season, I don't know. It's difficult. I'd probably say maybe a 6. First season. This season was probably 3 or 4. I just wanted to say, Jack, I did like some. I liked a lot of Superman scenes, like especially when he rescues the nuclear submarine in North Korea. I thought that was really cool. And again, my big problem with what they're doing with, is it the CW? Is that?
Uh-huh.
That's the channel. Now, they just are too preachy. And I just wish they wouldn't do that. Superman should be a shining example of what people should be. He should try to bring people together. He shouldn't try to separate people or, you know, take sides unless it just seems like it's getting very political. To me, Superman always represented the American way. And I know recently in comics, and I know a lot of it had to do with the fact that Trump was president and that a lot of the writers are like, oh no, Superman can't stand for the American way anymore. it's just wrong. So he basically denounces standing for the American way. And so now he says truth, justice, and that's it. And so that says, I stand for truth, justice, and that's it. And I just don't think that's right. That's not how the writers that created him had in mind. Because look at his suit. His suit is basically the colors of the flag. He's an American hero. He was born and raised in Smallville, which is basically like Kansas. And, you know, he learned American values. And I'm not saying this country is perfect. Yeah, we do have problems, but you just can't focus on the negative. You also have to accept the fact that there are a lot of positives about this country and there are a lot of good people in this country. We need to work on the negatives for sure, but you just can't look at America as an evil place and that it's kind of shouldn't be put in Superman's forefront. But I do get the fact that Superman is a world superhero and that he should be involved in not only world conflicts, but, you know, outside of the Earth too. And it kind of reminded me of Superman 4, which again, it's not a very good movie, but there are good scenes in it. And one of my favorite scenes in the movie is when Superman rescues the Russians out in space. And he brings one of the guys that's on a spacewalk that was going off into space. He brings him back to his craft. And he talks to them in Russian. And I'm like, that's awesome. Because that's what I would expect Superman to do. I don't think that I think he realized what his responsibility is as being Superman. I don't think his main goal should be to woo Lois or go to a bar or go to a football game or anything like that. He wants to help the world. And by doing that, I think it's important to him that he knows how everybody talks in the world too. I think there's also a scene in there where he's in Italy and he might speak Italian. I forget, but there are a lot of times when you see Superman speaking a different language. And I think that's fantastic because that's how I would want to picture Superman. So I was totally okay with him rescuing the North Korean soldiers or military that were in the nuclear sub. But then when he gets back, you know, the U.S. military is like, well, where's the sub? It's like, you know, whose side are you on? You should have basically left the sub with us, not them. And again, they're trying to villainize the United States military. This is all fiction, but I think that they are pushing an agenda that the United States is bad, it's corrupt, especially the military. So basically the military, the head of the military now is like, well, you know what? You're basically a traitor. We want you on our team, but if you're not going to pledge allegiance to this country, then there's the door. So Superman's on his own. And I just think that that's bull crap because all I wanted Superman to say was he did say, I am a hero for the world, or he said something like that, but he should have said, I'm a hero for the world, but I love my country. That's all he had to say. And I would have shut up about the whole thing. But the fact that it's almost like they're trying to create a character that he shouldn't be. I think that he should be grateful. And he was, and I guess my whole thing is I remember Superman, the movie, and Christopher Reeve's portrayal. And his whole thing was he wanted to feel like one of the people in Smallville, in Metropolis, even though he knew he wasn't, even though he knew he probably could rule the world if he wanted to, like if he was evil, he could take over everything, but he just wanted to be one of them. And he was so grateful that the Earth was his adoptive home and that the Kents were his adoptive parents that taught him good American values. And he did realize that this country is not perfect. You have people like Lex Luthor in this country. You have villains that he has to go against, bank robbers or whatever the hell. My point is, again, Superman should stand for the United States. He shouldn't shy away from America. And I do think that that's what the writers are trying to do. All right, so I got that part off of my my what do you want to call it? My trough, I guess.
Okay. Can I respond to this part?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. No, I get what you're saying completely. But in the comics for a long time, Superman has been fending off. He does help America. He wants, but Superman wants to help everybody. And this is prior to President Cheeto coming in. He was going with this, that it's like, you know what? He helps everyone despite politics and stuff. And like this predates Trump going through where he was a hero of the world.
No, I know that. I know.
I think the best line of it that sums up the characterization they've been going was like in Man of Steel, when the general at the end, when he crashes the satellite and the general is like, well, how do we know you put America first? And he's like, I grew up in Kansas, you know, like.
But that's Superman. That's not this Superman.
Right. But that's kind of like the way the WB has been going. WB, Warner Brothers. CW, of course, is a spinoff. But even last year, you know, he found out that the Army was, you know, having that Batman mentality of, oh, if there's even a 1% chance he could turn against us, we have to do something.
But Jack, well, but why is that? It's because of the writing.
Yeah, but like I said, but this is a theme that has followed Superman's relationship with the military for ages. And the same thing, like, there wasn't a lot of good in Superman 4, but, you know, that put it into perspective that he's there to save the world, not America, not Russia, not North Korea, not Italy. He's there to help everybody.
Well, let me ask you this, Jack. Which military looked better, the North Koreans or the United States?
Well, they didn't show much of North Korea. All they show in North Korea is everybody screaming because the sub was sinking. I mean,
no, but they also were
thankful that he lifted it, which was a very cool scene.
Yeah, no, but they were hugging each other. They were praising Superman. They were thanking him. And then when he gets back to the United States, get out of here. You know, it's like, you traitor.
Well, that's just it. You know, it's this has been brewing forever. But I'm saying this isn't indicative of Superman and Lois. This is Superman's relationship in the movies, in the TV shows.
And by the way,
passed away
while Trump was president. Jim Lee made the decision to get rid of the American way.
That's what? Jim Lee. We all know he has.
Well, but I'm just telling you that it happened during Trump's presidency. That was their whole thing, is they were so offended by the fact that Trump was president. They're like, well, we can't have Superman be on the side of the United States. Because we're evil.
He's the guy who got through it. But Superman saying he is a hero for the world, that predates Trump.
I know, and I explain that too, but I'm just saying what they're doing with this show is they're pushing the fact that America is bad. Superman needs to embrace other countries. And I just feel that again, that he should still embrace this country. You know, why, you know, if he's got such a problem, I don't know.
I think he does, or he would cut out the military completely. But he still goes back to them and keeps them in the loop. I think what we're seeing is foreshadowing with this, where they're making their little super team. And because the Justice League got wiped out by Doomsday, I think we're seeing the whole recruits of who's going to be the stand-in team that Doomsday wipes out.
Did you see episode 3?
I haven't seen it yet. This is what I'm saying. I have to catch up on stuff. But I just saw that as foreshadowing that General, who's the guy who's running this program?
He's an idiot, whoever he is.
Yeah, well, I think he's going to be like, nope, we'll handle it. And then the proverbial Doomsday hits the fan. I think it's foreshadowing. But I think you're reading too much into it. But
No, I don't think I am.
Okay, so next point. Next point you hate.
Next point is kids are spoiled brats. I just don't like them. This kid is 15 years old, and I don't know if you've got up to that point yet where he basically, he's going out with Lana's daughter, and he wants to reveal to her that he's got powers and his father's Superman. And Clark's like, no, you can't do that. And he's like, but why not? You know, it's like, because I love her. It's like, are you kidding me? Are you absolutely kidding me? If my dad was Superman, I couldn't be happier than can be. I mean, I know that one kid doesn't have powers. He's going to get powers eventually. I guarantee it. But it's just crazy and so spoiled that they don't kiss the ground every day that their father is Superman. If they understand what he's going through, instead of it's like, oh, poor me, look what I have to go through. I have these superpowers, but I really like this girl, but she's blown me off. But I think she'd really like me if she knew I had these powers and my dad was Superman. So I'm going to tell her, just thought you'd want to know, Dad. You know, those kids are just brats. I just don't like them.
I don't think they're brats. I think they're just dopey 15-year-old kids.
Which are brats.
They're not I don't think they're brats. I just think they're dopey 15-year-old kids.
Well, again, this is all fiction. It's not like the actors are like this. I just don't like the story. You know, I'm just trying to say that. And then Lois. Lois uses that damn beeper. Like, whenever there's an emergency, Superman has this, he gave people that are close to him this beeper. They push the button and he comes running within 3 seconds, wherever he was, or wherever he is in the world.
They had that in the comics. Jimmy Olsen even had
them. I am not finished. So she catches, not Jordan, Jonathan, in his bedroom with his shirt off, kissing his girlfriend, and she pushes the beeper. It's like, come on. Is that an emergency? Is that really an emergency that you have to call Superman, who is maybe about minutes before he was rescuing a nuclear submarine in North Korea? And she's like, you need to talk to your son. She's another one. She's a pain in the ass. She's annoying. Superman did the worst mistake in the world marrying her and having kids. Again, it's fiction. I'm just saying I don't like the show. And I would rather see more Superman. I don't want to see Lana Lang running for mayor. Or what was the deal with Lois and her sister? I still don't understand it. Didn't her sister say something to somebody and she committed suicide? And I'm confused with, you notice I just zoned out on it. Cause it's like
the sister had always seemed to have some sort of problems in the comics. And, you know, well, it was basically cause, you know, dad was in the military and did whatever. I don't remember them ever saying what happened to Lois Lane's mom. But him being, you know, constantly weighing the military and stuff, you know, Lois kind of had to take charge and her sister kind of was a wild child a bit, I guess. I don't know.
No, I remember too. I remember, and I think her sister was suicidal at one point, and one in the comics I read, I think she tried to jump off of a building and then Superman rescued her, but it ended up being Bizarro.
Yeah, that was pretty funny. It was funny in the comic books. Bizarro. Well,
so if you like Bizarro, Jack, and I know if you haven't seen episode 3, you might like episode 3.
I am enjoying the show. I know there's a lot of angst and there's a lot of cheese, but you know what? We all need some cheese in our life. Just watch the 6:30 World News Tonight, and then you're in the mood for some just lighthearted cheese. And that's what you get with this show. If you just go into this show too serious, it's not a serious show. It's a CW comic book show. You got to know what to expect from it. And I know Joe hated Supergirl when it came on. I have to say, this is leaps and bounds better than Supergirl.
I just don't like, these shows getting too preachy. And I think that they are getting very preachy.
I don't think this is anywhere near as preachy.
Well, no, I don't. That's why
last two seasons were nearly unwatchable because of the preachiness.
Yeah, that's why I stopped watching it in the first season. But, you know, I heard it got worse and I was like, yeah, I'm just going to stay away from that. And yeah,
but this Superman is Lois is very much like Peter Tomasi's run of Superman, with Lois and Clark dealing with being parents to a child with the same powers as Superman. It's very close to it. And Tomasi did, it was a great run. And too bad he left and Bendis took over. Even though I like Bendis, he kind of did things like age the son up very quickly. And, you know, it just wasn't the same. But Tomasi did a great job with it of Superman being a dad. And as a dad, I enjoyed it. And as a dad, I enjoy this show.
I think he's a horrible father, too. I think both of the parents are horrible because they have spoiled brats for kids.
I don't think they're spoiled brats. I just think they're kids. I don't know.
And then this
having one upstairs right now, I think they're just kids.
And then John Steele's daughter somehow shows up. I missed the last three episodes of this first season. So somehow she's come from the alternate universe.
Yeah, you kind of know she was going to show up. They showed her too much and talked about her too much in the first season. Of
course. Well, yeah, but I didn't know she was going to show up. I thought it was just a fluke that he was able to come over. But
no.
the whole thing with her, though, that's annoying is she's perfect. She's absolutely perfect. It's the father. Lana Lang's father buys Sarah a car for her birthday. And he's spending months working on this car, trying to get it running. This girl who's from an alternate universe is like, oh, wow, a 78 Mustang. What a beast. Can I work on that car? Because I'm really good with cars, you know. And within 2 minutes, she has the car running by opening up the carburetor.
You know who she's modeled after, right?
No.
She's modeled after, what's her name, Rory, whatever, Ironheart.
Or Rory Williams?
Rory Williams, who took over for Iron Man. She's modeled completely after that character.
So
where she's this technical genius kid. And of course you can figure out a combustible engine.
No, but she worked on 78 Mustangs back in her alternate universe, which I find completely hard to believe. And then she challenges Jonathan to a game at Madden, which I can't believe that Madden, the Madden football video game, exists in an alternate universe.
You don't think Tony Stark couldn't pick up that game and ace it?
No, but she played Madden in the alternate universe.
Why not? There was a Lois Lane in that alternate universe. There was a Superman in that alternate universe.
And then that's the whole thing.
John Madden is eternal. He's inevitable.
I don't want to hear it. But, you know, and also Lois is supposed to be her mother in an alternative universe, but Lois died in that universe. Superman killed her. So she's all pissed off because this Lois is in this universe and she's alive, but she's not her mother. Can't she accept the fact that it's not the same person? It's like if you have twins, it doesn't mean that that person is the same exact person.
But
you know,
she's a kid.
I don't like spoiled kids. I don't like spoiled kids. And I think that all these kids are spoiled.
I know you think all these kids are spoiled, but all these kids are just.
Spare the rod and spoil the child. That's what I say.
Whatever.
What talking about 10, 15 minutes ago, the hellish childhood.
Well, yeah, because it's like, look what I went through.
Like, wait, here it comes.
Look at the things I had to go through. You know, it's like everybody else has got to go through the crap that I had to go through. Yeah, there we go. I also think Superman needs to shave. He shouldn't have that almost a beard. It's like supposed to be a 5 o'clock shadow. It's like if Clark's got a 5 o'clock shadow and Superman's got a 5 o'clock shadow, someone's got to put two and two together.
overall, he's still my favorite Superman since Christopher Reeve. He has a earnestness about him that Henry Cavill wasn't allowed to have. You know, I mean, I think if Henry Cavill had somebody else directing him, I think we would have seen a better Superman. But, you know, we got emo Superman instead, because Henry Cavill looks the part, but this guy, he just seems the part. He has that easygoing nature to him, that being good just comes easy to him. And that's what Superman is. Superman's supposed to be better than all of us. Just like in Marvel, Captain America is supposed to be better than all of us. Things and petty differences that bug the hell out of us don't bother him. And Superman's supposed to be the same way. And I think this guy pulls off this attitude where he made peace with the guy who was married to Lois in the alternate universe. And he's like, you know what? We're friends now. I'm going to help you. I don't care. I'm going to help you.
So, Fedra, so this guy that's in the alternate universe was married to Lois Lane, and he somehow comes over into this universe and tries to kill this Superman because that Superman in the alternate universe killed his wife. But he ends up not killing him. But what is it? They're kind of homeless, so they invite them to live in their house together. Now, would you do that if you knew that this guy was married to your wife and he still has the hots for her? Did you get my question?
Yes, but I would keep a real close eye on him.
Exactly.
If I had a Rottweiler, it would be right there.
But Joseph Hogarty is not Superman. Superman is a
better
person than Joe Hogarty, Jack McCarthy, and even Fedra. This guy is now his friend. Until this guy betrays him, Superman is going to trust him and treat him like a friend. That is just Superman. This is what Joe is talking about right now. It's the problem why so many people have a problem writing Superman and writing Captain America. They cannot cope or imagine how someone who is so innately good can operate in the world around them.
Well Jackie,
so they have to pick some flaws and stick them in that the character really shouldn't have.
You don't think at some point that those two are going to kiss?
That's a great point, Jack.
I'm not, but that's on them. That's not on Superman. Superman trust him. This guy says he's his friend. Helped him save the world. Superman trusts this guy now. If he betrays him, Superman may punch him into orbit. But right now, they're friends, and Superman trusts his friends.
Well, I hope they do cheat, because you know what? Because Superman can do much better than this Lois anyway.
This Lois.
All right, let's move on. I'll save something I was going to talk about for next week since we're running kind of long. Well, let's get into the news. So I wanted to thank Dan for alerting me to this story. I told you guys about Peter Dinklage blasting Disney over the live Snow White.
Yeah, good for him.
Oh, okay. So we're going to have a little battle here. All right, Fedra, so what's your schmeal with this, or your take on this?
No, I mean, I just think that from what I read in the article that he had a point, and he said it, and good for him. I mean, he's a famous actor, so he's just utilizing his fame and his platform to just put on his opinion. And, you know, go to him for saying that, because I think his points were very valid. And I mean, we're going to see what they do with the movie, but I really agree that they're still perpetuating the underlining message of Snow White. And I was pretty blunt about that with you guys. I don't know which episode, and I can say it again if you guys want me to, but yeah, I think it was very accurate what he said.
All right, well, Jack, do you have any opinion on that?
Honestly, I don't know what the heck Disney is doing. Like, considering they are supposed to be the house of the mouse and super creative, why are they going back to the well to redo stories they've already done? That said,
they make
why
money.
Are they now trying to be so politically sensitive in some regards? Like, honestly, I have never thought of the seven dwarves being serious counterparts for real people. To me, the seven dwarves are magical beings just like elves, just like hobbits. These are not true people that were born with this condition. These are magical beings who live out in the forest, who talk to animals, you know, work in a gem mine where gems the size of, you know, someone's head gets pulled out of the ground every day. Like, if they're pulling these gems out every day, why the heck are they at living in a little tiny cottage in the woods?
That's true.
I don't know. So these are not meant to be stand-ins for real people. And once you start trying to make those sensitivities of them to real people, then you're going to get yourself in trouble. And this is something Disney doesn't get. And the same thing, Snow White is as white, her skin was white as snow. Well, why do you have a Latin girl playing her? You know, can't we just, you know, to follow Joe's point, follow the source material? You know, that's just it. Gal Gadot is the evil queen. I think she's going to be awesome as the evil queen. But let's face it, are we now going to be upset because, you know, oh, she becomes an ugly witch at the end? Oh, no, you know, witches can't be ugly. No, witches are magical people in Snow White, in fairy tales. You're not going to tell the whole Wiccan community that they should all be hunched over.
Here comes Fedra.
Craggy ladies. You know, but this mm-hmm. is what these are magical people.
You the say way, it, Jack.
The same way you can't make these assumptions. And who does this woman talk to? She talks to Amira, who answers her back and strokes her ego. What are we going to do? Be
AKA Satan.
Mirror makers now? I mean, come on, this is a fairy tale. These are magical settings. Don't put real world hangups on magical stories, magical fairy tales. You know, take them in the spirit they're meant to. That's the first part. The other part is, who's screaming for a live action version of these old Disney cartoons?
Wait a minute, Jack. I would love to see a live action, except you know who I would pick to do this? Tim Burton. I want Tim Burton and Danny Elfman, and I want them to make the creepiest Snow White ever.
That would be a crazy-ass Snow White.
Heck yeah! Well,
I would be okay with that, Fedra, but it can't be Disney Snow White. It might be... Is Snow White a Brothers Grimm tale? I don't think so.
And actually,
yes, it is. She was Rose Red. She was Rose Red.
But even
do that one.
The dwarves were horrible to her. The dwarves took her in and made her work. There wasn't dancing with the mop and.
You're talking about the Grimm fairy tale, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
They took her in and used her as like a maid. You know, they weren't nice to her. And, you know, but we're going to see the dancing scenes and, you know, don't be waving his hat around and bashful hiding his hat. These are not supposed to be stand-ins for real people. They're supposed to be magical beings. What, you know, what's next? Are we going to stop watching Lord of the Rings? Because, you know, Gimli's cranky all the time, and, you know, he's kind of heavy and lumbers and all this stuff. Gimli's a magical person. He's not real. You know, come on, you know.
No, they were real in The Lord of the Rings. I mean, no, the elves were real. And then
or even the Hobbit, that travesty, you know, with the dwarves acting like they were. No one said, hey, you know what? The little guy in my office, you know, I bet he can throw plates around like that and sing songs like that. Like, no, you idiot. That's a magical being on screen you're watching. That's not real. Anybody who's watching this movie should know that. Not, oh, we have to be, you know, politically sensitive to this. It's like the same asinine stuff in Dungeons and Dragons going on where, you know, we can't have prejudice against races in Dungeons and Dragons. What are they talking about? They're talking about the prejudice against a group of evil elves who worship demons and kill people all over the place. Well, you know, you can't make that assumption. You kind of can in a magical setting like Dungeons and Dragons. Nobody looks at these creatures and say, it's really a shame the drow have had it so hard that no one likes them. You know, yeah, because that's the way the characters were made. Same way Seven Dwarfs. The dwarfs were all these goofy seven little guys living in a cottage in the woods, digging in the mines, having fun. Would you be singing if you were digging in a mine with a pickaxe? These guys are. So you can't do that. It doesn't fit. The whole argument is inane. And Peter Dinklage is right that, like, you know what? This is just a farce. And that's what I have to say, Joe. Sorry.
Well, I will say
too long.
You didn't. I give credit to Dinklage for one thing, is that he brings awareness to the fact that Disney's making this stupid movie. Which I'm like with Fedra and Jack, I guess, is with this too. We don't need to see live remakes of every Disney animated movie. You know, they're doing a live action remake of the Aristocrats.
Yeah.
Aristocats. I mean, come on. You know, it's just, they are just doing it for the money. They, they're, what is the word I'm looking for? They're creatively bankrupt. They don't have any real ideas that they can make movies with. So they just basically are either doing sequels, or they're taking old movies and remaking them, or making live action movies. I don't want to see a live action Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, but Disney wants to say, you know why? Because these movies do make money. If they don't make $1 billion, like Beauty and the Beast made $1 billion, it's going to make close to $1 billion, or it'll make $500 million. And you know what? That's money for them. That's money for their shareholders. I don't like it, but I understand why they're doing it, because it's all about money. But with that being said, I think what Dinklage said, I think he's being a big little jerk over the fact that the things that he said, because number one, the dwarves in Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, they were the good guys. They were the heroes. They were the ones that basically rescued Snow White.
Yeah, they took out the witch, didn't they?
They were the ones that killed. The only thing that the prince did was he basically frolicked throughout the woods on his horse, and then he sees her in the glass coffin, opens it up, gives her a kiss, and that's it. He's the big hero. No, they are the heroes. They killed the witch. They were not afraid of her. They attacked her. And they were scared that, you know, they told her be careful. But if they were around, they would have kicked her ass, you know, from one side of fantasy world to the other. They were cool characters. They were little heroes. And I know people might say, well, you can't say little. No, they are. You have to state the fact of what they are. There's nothing wrong with being little, especially, you know, size has nothing to do with it. You can have really big jerks, or, you know, that you don't want to have anything to do with, or you can have really little heroes that are great people. It shouldn't matter what size.
Fedra's like, I'm right here.
Whenever you're done.
Oh, I didn't see that. Oh, I didn't. I didn't see that. Sorry, Fedra. I had my thing off. But I just think that he's making a big deal out of nothing. I think, like, again, like if Jack and I say, like, we were dwarves in this kingdom, and we just didn't get along with the people in the village, or like they might have mocked us for our size, or they didn't want to play basketball with us or whatever, we'd go out and we'd find a little place and invite other people that were our size into that place, and then go digging for jewels, and we were going to be rich, and we'd have the last laugh, you know?
And then buy the town and kick them all out.
Well, yeah, I probably would.
If a hot brunette wants to come by and live with us in the cottage, come on over.
It's very weird. The whole story is very weird.
Yes, it is extremely weird.
Because she's like 12 to 15 years old, Snow White, in the book and in the movie. And she just gets married at the end. The whole story. I do love that animated movie. I think it's a classic. It's one of Disney's best. But I hope that in a way this stops Disney from making it, because they haven't gone into production yet, and they could basically say, you know what, there's just too much controversy, we're not going to do it. You know, we'll do 101 Dalmatians or something. You know,
but even that, though, I mean, why just restore the classic film? Give it some touch up with the computers, restore it to a beautiful state, and re-release it.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what Disney used to do.
Bring their kids to see like these classic animated movies restored on a big screen. There are tons of them.
That's what Disney used to do that. Like when we were younger, like,
yes, I remember.
They would release their movies every 7 years. And every 7 years, people would go and sell at the theater to go see those movies. And the same thing with video, you know, on VHS.
The Fort Wayne in Brooklyn, every Wednesday, they would show a different Disney movie. And all through grammar school, even up to like sixth and seventh grade, you would go and you would watch one of these Disney movies every week. And all they would do is just keep recycling through them, you know. So if you missed Snow White, well, you know what? In 3 months, it'll be back on Wednesday.
Well, that's not what I said. I said every 7 years.
No, but I'm saying these are theatrical releases that they would just keep putting it on. And you know what? They'd get a filled house with all us kids throwing popcorn, eating crap, and watching a movie. And if they did it again, they would still make money. I mean, these old films probably need to be spruced up a bit, but I mean, let's face it, you know, prior to that string of the Aristocats and Robin Hood and the Jungle Book, prior to that, the Disney movies had a very different style of animation that was beautiful. And people would go see that. The Snow White, the Sleeping Beauty, you know, Peter Pan, they would still go. But can you imagine if they made a real live action Peter Pan now?
Well, they wouldn't have the Indians in it.
Well, people would be screaming, you know, the way Tinkerbell was, you know, pirates.
You know how many live action Peter Pans they've had in the last 10 years? They've had a lot. They had a movie called Peter Pan. They had a movie called Pan. They had a movie called Wendy. And I'm probably missing some. There are a ton of live action Peter Pan movies. Fred, you want to get back into this?
Oh, yeah, here we go.
So, listeners, if you have your trusty phone or laptop, go to Wikipedia and look up dwarf folklore. It states, in Germanic folklore, including Germanic mythology, a dwarf is an entity that dwells in the mountains and in the earth. The entity is associated with wisdom, smithing, mining, and crafting. Dwarfs are sometimes described as short, and ugly. However, some scholars have questioned whether this is a later development stemming from comical portrayals of the beings. I have a little bit more. I just need to find my place. So after the Christianization of the Germanic peoples, tales of dwarves continued to be told in the folklore areas of Europe where Germanic languages were spoken. In the late legendary sagas, dwarves demonstrated skill in healing as well as in smithing. In the early Norse sources, there is no mention of their being short. So I just wanted to point that out because it's really depending on, you know, what mythology that you read of the description of dwarves, just like you said, as far as being a mythical creature. It does say that they were described as old men and long beards. And the reason for that is, again, that depiction of being wise beyond your years, you know? So I wanted to point that out because I think that's a great thing that you're pointing out there, Jack, that, you know, I get that they may not want to offend
little people
or that community, but at the same time we're talking about folklore, not actual people or a community. So then therefore, if it is folklore and mythology, there is room for interpretation. And if they're going to do it in the mountains and the earth, then I think that they should stick to the true story, which is that they were in a cottage. And the other thing I wanted to point out is that with that mining of the gems, they're showing the other side because they show the queen and they show Snow White in royalty. So, of course, they have to show the other side, which is the workmen. What you see is their humility. The fact that they mine these gems and they sing and they work all day long and you don't see them take those gems, right? They work and they go home. Why? Because they find meaning in what they do, which is working, singing, drinking, and dancing. You know, that's their, you know, joy. And so, you know, when they take, you know, Snow White in, it's, you know, it's also based on her skill. What can she do to stay? And that's what they did. They made her a maid and a cook. So, you know, I hope they don't take, you know, that aspect out, because you're showing the time frame. Like, that is, you know, medieval time frame, okay? And so in medieval, you know, time frame, you know, if she's a true young princess, there were certain things that she knew how to do, and there were certain things she never did before. So it's also this showing of the humility of Snow White maturing as a woman, you know, and being under the spell and challenging the queen and all that stuff. So, you know, I get what, you know, his name, Peter
Dinklage.
Dinklage said, and I can see that also. But like, if you're gonna tell the story of how it was written, you know, don't tinker with it so much. You know, I get that they maybe want to showcase, you know, diversity in there, but it just doesn't make sense. I'm glad, Jack, that you quoted, you know, from the story that her skin was white as snow. So if you're going to do that, I mean, heck, you know, get an albino then, you know, get someone that showcases. I'm serious, though. I mean, I'm serious. Like, if you're going to do it right then, you know.
But she's got to be super beautiful, too.
Right. So then they can have either.
Well, she's the fairest of all.
Right. I mean, we have technology now where we can do that, but it's like, if you're gonna make it as true to the story, then do that. But I feel like they're just picking and choosing to try to make everyone happy, and they're seeing that it's exploding in their face. It ain't working.
Well, I think the bottom line, though, is everybody, well, a lot of these actors and a lot of people are just too sensitive to things. I don't see, after all the years that he's lived on this earth, why something like this should bother him. I just don't get it. Because again, I do think that they're heroes. He shouldn't be looking at them as buffoons. I didn't really see that. And also, to your fact, in the Disney animated movie, Snow White wanted to be a maid and a cook. You know, they didn't tell her. It's like, well, we're away. You need to cook and you need to clean up the place. You know, she was happy. She had a place to stay after that huntsman almost ripped her heart out.
Well, you know, they could also play that for gags, too. If she was a princess, she could be learning how to cook. So dwarves are working the whole day. They come home and she's made a horrible soup.
No, yeah. But she was.
But and then
she
you have like the seven dwarves crying in their soup because they don't want to hurt her feelings. You know, you could play that for gags. A whole.
Well, she was like the queen's slave. You know, when she was living in the castle, you know, she was doing work there too. So she knew how to cook.
I think she was a spoiled brat. She should have been happy she was living in the castle, Fedra. She could have kissed the ground the queen worked on. She gave her a roof. She gave her food, even though she had to work for it. Gave her a work ethic. I think Snow White was a spoiled brat.
She probably was.
There's such an undertone to that I am not going to get into. I mean, really, like, if I could work with Tim Burton, I would be like, dude, let's figure out a way to get Snow White to wake up, and then she goes after the queen and she takes her castle back, and then there ain't no prince, you know, she just rules, and you know, her dwarf friends come to the castle to celebrate, and they drink and they be merry and they celebrate the death of the evil queen. Like, that would be cool.
The witch could be halfway beaten. And then Snow White standing there, and Sleeping Beauty appears next to her. And, you know, Pocahontas shows up and, like, takes off her helmet and grows, like, 2 feet or something, you know.
Come on, Jack.
And the fairies come, and they're surrounding, you know, putting all happy magic on the castle again.
No, the fairies show up there and roll up their sleeves, you know.
Well, that would never happen.
And they destroy the mirror, too.
Yeah. They all take place in different time periods. I'm sorry, guys. Anyway.
That'd be kind of cool, too. Yeah.
Anyway.
That big girl power moment.
Mm-hmm. So really quick. So I had sent you, I sent some pictures to you guys. Well, you know Mary Elizabeth Winstead, right, Fedra? And I know Jack knows her.
Check.
You know, she's one of those actresses. I know the name, but I just can't picture her.
Well, she was in Scott Pilgrim.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And she was in Birds of Prey.
Mm-hmm.
She was in Death Proof with Quentin Tarantino.
Cloverfield. What are the Cloverfield?
Yeah, Clover. 10 Cloverfield, okay. Whatever. Anyway, she's going to be in the Ahsoka Tano TV series. I always thought she was hot. So I'm pretty happy with that. I really am glad that she's going to be part of that. So I'm pretty pleased. I think she's very attractive.
Is she going to fit the character?
Well, we don't know what character she's playing, but I'm just happy. You know, just like Jennifer Beals being in Boba Fett. I'm just happy that they're getting work because they're such beautiful people. they also announced that Natasha Lou Bordizzo will play Sabine Wren.
And I think she has the right look for the character.
I do too.
She looks like she could be very good Sabine.
Yeah, I think she looks pretty good. What was the other one? Oh, and what's her name? Zoe Saldana.
Yeah, Zoe looks great.
Yeah, so she's.
But I don't think she looks that different than she looked in the other movies.
Yeah, people are saying online, it's like, ooh, she's got yellow in her eyes. She had yellow in her eyes in the previous ones. It's just that you really couldn't see it because it really wasn't highlighted the way it was. She doesn't look like, you know, the comic book one, but She looks the same. I think people are just...
Yeah, because in the comics, the yellow is like over up to her eyebrows and like downward cheekbones. It's really a large like, area. This is just looks like eyeshadow.
Kind of like Domino in the comics.
Kind of, in Two Eyes, though.
Yeah. But no, she looks good. I'm glad they're starting to film this because, damn, I want to see the third one. Anyway, that's the news. Let's get into the Book of Boba Fett. So I have to assume that the two of you have seen it.
Yes.
Yes.
All right. So let's go with Fedra first. So what do you think, Fedra?
All right. Well, I got to say, I never, ever give up on the Force. Because this episode, I deem 7 to 8 out of 10.
That's very high for you.
First 6 minutes was fan-freaking-tastic. I love the whole concept of these bulldogs, you know, chopping this meat. And just out of nowhere, Mando just comes right through, you know, and just roll right into it. Loved it. I love the discussion between... And I didn't ever really mention her in when we were talking about the Mandalorian, but since, you know, she makes this, you know, visit in this episode, I believe it's pronounced the Armorer.
Yeah.
I actually love this character. I think I'm falling more and more in love with it. And as I've said that I was very disappointed in Fennec being kind of an AI / female human. Now I actually have a new female, you know, persona that I like, and I like the fact that she's very wise, she's very firm, and she's very authoritative. However, when you look at her demeanor and the way that she dressed, it's very feminine. I wrote it down, literally, I did, guys. She has a nice little fur shawl, okay? And then she has this nice little burgundy tunic that she's wearing, with pants and some high boots, and then she's holding on to these heavy, you know, pieces of metal, whether it's a pipe or a wrench, as her weapons. So I wanted to say that because I never really, you know, looked at it, but I want to say that as far as the cut and design of her costume, it is very feminine. So I like that it's not just masculine.
Does she have a nice slit up the leg too? I didn't notice that.
Right. And you know, I mean, it's like, that is very subtle, you know, it doesn't have to be like so extreme where she's like in a bikini with, you know, a bow and arrow and a sword, you know.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to see her in a bikini, but I didn't think she looked masculine at all. I mean, no, I didn't think she looked feminine at all, I'm trying to say. But, you know, I when I see her at times, I can't tell that she's a woman, mostly because she's got a helmet on, you know.
Right, but I mean the subtlety in how, you know, how she moves, like even when they have that fight where Paz Vizsla challenges Mando, and it's literally, I'm sorry, it's a very typical female scene. She's just looking at him and they're like, okay, you done yet? Yeah, because you lost. So you're gonna take your helmet off? Yeah, I didn't think so. Move on, you know? Like that was great. That's like, to me, that's a perfect example of, you know, showing that feminine side in a very firm, but very realistic way. Like, come on, guys, like, you done here? You know, like, I loved that. I know that you were saying, Joe, in our discussion about Mando, you know, missing Grogu. And there's a scene in here that the reasoning behind it makes sense to me. So, you know, as they're forging, trying to forge the spear because it's useless in their creed. So he's saying like, oh, let's make something for Grogu. And she reminds him that, you know, the Jedi don't have attachments, which is true. But he states that in his creed, it's loyalty and solidarity. And I literally wrote that down because that makes sense. that means that even if Grogu is not attached to him or doesn't remember him, Mando does. And so this reasoning behind him missing him is that, you know, he just wants to make sure that he's safe and that he's, you know, ready. So I guess that's why he wants to forge some type of weapon as a solidarity of their friendship. And so the last thing I thought was hilarious, it was a very small moment, but it was like that TSA moment of the galaxy where he's literally putting all his weapons in the freaking box. And the droid is like, yes, proceed. It was like, I know that that was so small, but it was just hilarious thinking like that would be in the galaxy. I mean, I really was surprised that he didn't like set him on fire or like chopped off his head or something. Cause I mean, I would have, you know, this amazing bounty hunter like has to put all his, you know, weapons in a box. And I love it. He's like, I know every single thing that's in this box. So, I mean, I loved it. I loved the entire thing. I wanted more. I mean, thank goodness. I'm like so grateful to the Force right now, you know, to the, all the Jedi and all the Sith and the whole Empire. Like, thank goodness for this episode, because I really needed to see something good. And yeah, overall, just fantastic. I can't wait.
Oh, cool. What about you, Jack?
I liked the episode a lot. We got to learn a bit more about the Mandalorian culture. We saw Night of a Thousand Screams or coming up. We hear a bit about, like I said, their faith and how important the planet it was to them, because the only ones who kind of survived were the ones who were off planet. Sort of like how it's been a running theme in the Star Wars novels and comics about how the old Iranians are, you know, how displaced they feel and how much they long for what's now just space dust after the Death Star. So, I mean, I like that. I also love what's her name on Tatooine.
One
who runs the docking port.
I wrote her name down. Pelimoto.
Yeah, I think she's hysterical. But I swear, every time she's on screen, I think of Tracy Ullman.
I forget the actress's name, but did you ever see Strangers with Candy? It was in Comedy Central.
Mm-hmm.
That's her.
But yeah, she just makes me think of Tracy Ullman. Her mannerisms, the way she speaks, and the side comments about, you know, Jawas, they're very furry. You know, like, it's just...
You know who else she is? She's James Caan's secretary in Elf.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, she is.
But I think she's terrific. And she's just one of those characters I think is fun to watch on screen. And I loved how, you know, of all the ships that they could bring back, it would be a Naboo fighter. And how she was working on it. And he's like, you know, I really want a Razor Crest. You know, but she's like, no, wait, let's build this up. And I never really liked it, but that ship style. But there's something that looks very cool with it, not so sleek and shiny. It looks much more Star Wars-y now in the show, where, you know, it's got some vents on it, has like different pieces welded onto it. It's not gleaming silver, you know.
You know, it's weird. A lot of people told me they didn't like the Naboo fighter. That was like the one thing in the Phantom Menace, or I like the, you know, the battle with Darth Maul and Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon, but I like that starfighter, the Naboo one. I thought it was really cool. I liked the design of it. It was different, you know, compared to the X-Wings.
It was different, but it never, like when you look at the X-Wing design is just so cool. the Naboo N1, it just looked very plasticky and shiny. It didn't feel like a Star Wars ship to me. And yes, it is a Star Wars ship, but maybe if we'd seen more of it in the prequel trilogies, maybe I'd feel a little different about it. But this one looks cool. And I just love the scene where he's trying it out and then he gets pulled over by the X-Wings for going too fast. I thought that was a funny scene. And then when he tests the booster, you know, and he just leaves them in the dust, I thought that was just a funny scene all around. But this was a good episode. But I think Joe has said it felt like it should have been the first episode of season 3 of The Mandalorian.
Yeah.
But you know what? It was great to see them. Maybe Kevin Feige has a better, and John Favreau just has a better feel for The Mandalorian than he does Boba Fett. Maybe that's it.
It's possible.
But I'm kind of looking forward to the gang all getting together and fighting the Pikes.
With the scooter utes?
Huh?
With the scooter utes?
Scooter utes.
Even though the scooter utes will be there, seeing the big black Wookiee, the Mandalorian, hell, throw Grogu in there too. You know, I'm kind of looking forward to that. Because you know what's coming. Everybody's going to have a moment in that fight.
So what would you rate it?
This one, I would probably give it about an 8 out of 10.
Wow. So I'm going to tell you my rating first.
Okay, say your rating first.
I'd give it a 9 out of 10. I actually thought it was really good. And this is like basically the problem with the Book of Boba Fett. How do you fix it? Get rid of Boba Fett. He just doesn't work. The Mandalorian does work. That's what Boba Fett should have been. And you might say, well, we can't have them being too similar because you have to show their differences. But no, that's what Boba Fett should be. He should be a bounty hunter. He should be kicking ass. You know, he shouldn't be Mr. Oh, you know, you have problems. You know, I'll pay for the water and all this crap. He's just too nice, Boba Fett. The Mandalorian, he's nice at times, but in that first scene, he came in and he kicked ass and he was killing people. He had no problems killing people. He got hurt, which showed he wasn't perfect. And that's one of the things that I always complain about is like our heroes can't be completely perfect. They have to show some sort of flaw in them. I think his biggest flaw though is Grogu, and I'll get to that in a minute. But I will say my problem with this was it was a little too Earth-like, that whole meat cleaving, you know, scene, you know, that they had wool hats on and that one of them had like a Mario cap on, you know, like one of those pea caps. And it's like, come on, and aprons, that's just a little too much.
On the Mandalorian, the Mon Calamari were wearing Irish sweaters.
I don't remember, but if that was the case, I probably didn't like that either. I just think that at times they need to pull back a little bit and realize that this is a galaxy far, far away, long time ago. I think that spaceport looked incredible. I just couldn't believe how well done that was and that we'd never seen anything like that before.
Well, what I was surprised at was Ringworld showing up.
Ringworld, what was that?
That where he was at the beginning.
Oh, that's Ringworld.
Well, it's Ringworld was a series of like big science fiction books by Larry Niven. And it's basically about one of these superstructures that is the whole planet is just a ribbon around a star.
Oh, well, that's what I liked. That's what I meant.
That was cool. But what I also liked is how in Ringworld, to keep everything, you know, in some sort of semblance of time, they had these huge plates that would sort of also orbit around the sun that would give day and night. And I liked that they remembered to incorporate that into the Star Wars version of it. So you remember, you'd see those like big white blocks. They would kind of go over and they would leave a shadow moving across the surface. That's what they had in the Ringworld books. And it was kind of cool to see that in action.
Yeah, I know. I really enjoyed this episode, and everything that you guys said, I echo. You know, especially the beginning, I really enjoyed when he met the armorer again. And it is weird that this wasn't the first episode of The Mandalorian. They couldn't have seen the feedback of the Book of Boba Fett and said, well, let's try to save this and we'll kind of shift the episode one over, because it was already too far in the can. So I think it was intentional. So next week, is he going to search for Grogu?
I don't know if they're going to show that or not.
Or that'll be in the Mandalorian, you think?
Well, heck, maybe he'll bring Grogu and Luke Skywalker back to fight for both of them.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, I think that that's the case. Well, I personally think that he is going to search for Grogu, because the Mandalorian's going to fight with Fennec and Boba Fett and their clan. So, but he's got to, he said he's got to go find Grogu first. So I think the next episode will be split in between Boba Fett and Fennec recruiting more people to fight for them against the Pikes. And we'll see Mandalorian go out and look for Grogu, and you'll probably see Luke Skywalker, because they did say that there was going to be like a big surprise. So maybe that's it. Maybe, or maybe it's the Mandalorian. I, unlike a lot of other people, especially Fedra, I don't like Grogu. First of all, like the Kent kids, he's a spoiled brat. You got to admit he's a spoiled brat. Look at Fedra's face. I wish people could see Fedra's face. He's 50 years old.
But he's still a baby.
And he's annoying. Why would you want to go visit this kid? You finally got him out of your life. I would wait for him until he can talk and be an adult before I'd go visit him again. But then he'd probably be dead, because if he ages so slowly, he'd have to wait like another 50 years. He's a pain in the ass. And I kept thinking about that. That kid on that ship must have been so annoying. He had to have changed his diaper, right? Good God. That must have been gross. I just don't like Grogu. You know, he's cute and everything, but I felt like he took away from The Mandalorian too, the series. And he made him, I know Jack hates when I use this word, soft. And I think that his love and affection, regardless of what Fedra had said previously, it makes him soft. There's no reason for him to go and visit Grogu. He's off on his own, training to be a Jedi. He needs to be away from any attachments. I just don't get it. I don't like the fact that they're bringing Grogu back.
I love it.
Well, I'm happy for you, not for me.
And I think that I think you're wrong about it, because I don't think the Mandalorian is soft. I mean, I think Boba's soft. Boba's definitely.
Oh no, no.
Mando, Boba. No. Mando just doesn't have anyone, and he's, you know, he's thinking about, you know, that's why he's
starting a family with Grogu.
Well, no, it's just that's his friend. Like that's the only thing that he can associate with that he like saved, you know, and you know, here everything in the galaxy was going after this thing that he was trying to, you know, understand, let alone communicate with. Yeah, I could definitely see that he was annoying, because he was like, I want to push the button. Oh, don't give me the button. Okay, I want the ball. Oh, you're not going to give me the ball. Okay, I want the frog. Now I can't eat the frog. Like, I love it. Like, I love it. It was just like, it was actually, to me, it reminded me of like the two grumpy old men, you know, except obviously Grogu can't talk, but it's all these little situations where, like you said, Mando was going out of his mind because he's been alone for so long, and all he does is his work. And now he has this like completely different situation that he has to adjust to. And so now that he's going back to his roots, he's, you know, now he has this huge responsibility with the dark saber and what that can entail for him. And so, yeah, it makes sense that he just has this kind of attachment to just make sure that he's safe. And that's kind of part of his family. I think it would be a great awakening for him to see that Grogu is improving in his training and he is actually disattached from him, because that will show that Grogu is growing up to be, I guess, a man, but not really a man, whatever. You know what I mean? Like maturity, you know, maybe that'll happen, but I wonder how that,
I hope he's like teenage Groot. Like, Greg,
right. And he's a pain in the butt even more. Like, he's like, okay,
he's just so I'm over leaving. Mandalorian. It's like, look, I've presented you with this special present. I've traveled galaxies to bring this to you. And you're like, he just walks away.
That'll be perfect, because then even in Star Wars, it's a thankless job. As I hear from all the parents, it's like, it's a
sometimes job. But it does have its rewards.
See, I mean, that'll be great if I look at if Luke just gives him this look like, can you take him back, can you just take him off?
Okay, that'd be good. You know? No, I hope that, well, I'd be okay with that. It's like, this just isn't working out. He craps all the time. You know how many diapers I go through a day with this thing? And he's never grateful.
Well, and I mean, I hope that they don't make him perfect either. I mean, we did see that in his training that he's young and that he was like trying to learn and pass the ball and do that. That was great. So I hope that if he is, you know, more mature, I hope he's not like overnight just amazing, because then that would just kill it for me too. I like the fact that they're showing, for me, it's not just that he resembles Yoda, it's just that it's just a different creature. I love in Star Wars that there's all these different species, and I want to see that. And from the writings, it said that there were a lot of Jedis that were different species, so I love when they can show that. And I want to see what his talents are and what his training is, and you know, how good he is in combat and all that stuff. You know, and I definitely do want to see what's the connection with Boba, but I agree with you that I hope there's no like bromance between like Boba and Mando about like, hey, I miss my sand kid, and like, yeah, I miss my Grogu. Like, I hope that does not happen, because then I gotta throw up.
Yeah, I don't want to see. This is what I kind of can see happening too, is that Boba Fett is getting his ass kicked with his scooter utes and his black Wookiee and everything, and then Mandalorian shows up and he holds Grogu up like John Cusack didn't say anything with the boombox. And he unleashes the force and he saves the day, and then he says, oh, have a ride on my Rancor, little Grogu.
Oh, please no. I'm with you on that one. Let's not have that happen.
I wouldn't be surprised. You know, if I was a betting man, I would say it's very possible that it'll happen.
And then Grogu rides off into the sunset on a Rancor.
Yeah. Or a Banta.
No, it gotta be the Rancor.
Well, you know that's coming too, when Boba Fett says, oh, I really wanted to ride one of these. You know he's gonna be, well, I think Jacket said that we're gonna be seeing him.
Coming.
Yeah. Bradley, actually, he contacted me and he made a good point about his new ship. It's not very practical for a bounty hunter. It's like, where do you store your bounties?
Well, it's better than public transportation.
True, but I'm just saying that he makes a good point, though. It's like, when you bring somebody in and you have to collect your bounty, where are you going to put him? Is he going to sit on your lap? Mm-hmm. You know, he had a hole like in the razor, you know, or he can put them in carbonite if he wanted to, which he did, I think, in the first episode.
Or maybe he's just taking them dead now, takes a head and wraps it up in a rag.
Or maybe he just like ties a rope around on them and puts it at the end of the ship. I don't know.
I hope he gets another ship, and this is just like the getaway ship, you know, because there isn't no room. It's literally just him. There's no room for anything. So hopefully this is just a starter to a bigger ship.
It's just room enough for him and Grogu. Grogu could sit on his little lap.
Oh,
but he made another point too. So why did the armorer ask him, did you ever take your helmet off?
Because of the vow.
What vow?
The vow that every Mandalorian takes, that they're not supposed to take off the helmet. And because he is the only one so far that has wielded the dark saber by a true fight, they want to make sure that the prophecy is true. So now, technically, I guess by the prophecy, he has to go back to the mines to atone for removing his helmet. Jack, correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, that's that sect of the Mandalorians. Because what's her name? Bo-Katan? And her friends had no qualms about taking their helmets off.
Gotcha.
But so that Mandalorian sect, that there's only the three of them left, that was the whole thing with that group.
Well, no, I knew of the vow, but I agree. I thought it was a weird time to ask the two of them if they took their helmets off. You know?
Well, that's what I thought. I mean, that when he had the knife to the other guy's throat, he was going to end it by pulling his helmet off instead of slitting the guy's throat, because that would invalidate him to hold a dark saber.
And I liked that guy too. He was cool. I liked him as a Mandalorian.
Yeah, that's true, right, Jack? Because then he would have to atone to be able to come back.
Right, he would no longer be considered Mandalorian,
right,
where he could wield the darksaber. But then again, the main Mandalorian, he didn't care. He just took the darksaber with him.
All right, well, we'll save listener email for next week since it's getting late. But let me just ask you this one question. So do you think that the next episode is going to be better or worse than this one?
Depends how they go with it.
Yeah, I just hope it's good. I'm just going to cross my fingers because I really want it to be.
What would be cool is if Fennec takes a ride to Mos Eisley and starts recruiting some of the aliens we saw in that first bar scene in A New Hope.
Oh, like the Blues Brothers?
No, like the Hammerhead and the Wolfman.
No, I know. No, I'm talking about the Blues Brothers, where they're like, we got to get the band back together.
No, I don't think they weren't all together, but it would be kind of a nice callback to A New Hope if they went and, you know, all of a sudden there's that big white furry guy with all the little eyes, or the little mousy guy. Like, she goes and recruits them into Boba Fett's muscle gang. Because Jabba had like a real menagerie in his palace in Return of the Jedi. It would be kind of a cool throwback if Boba kind of got that kind of group together, as opposed to just the scooter utes.
I think that's what Fennec is implying with the fact that he has a lot of credits. What would be really cool is if Mando goes into the mines and finds that there is a whole other sect, and that they can pledge to work with Boba if Mando atones. And once they find out he has the dark saber, that'd be kind of cool.
I'd be completely happy if they just blew up Tatooine at the end.
No.
Well, we've seen Tatooine way too many times in the Star Wars stories. And also, I want Boba Fett and Fennec to be on that planet when it happens, because I don't ever want to see them again.
Won't someone think of the sand people?
Oh, yeah, the sand people. Those poor sand people babies.
Exactly.
And their puppies.
Someone think of the sand children.
And the baby banthas.
And the baby banthas.
All right. Let's wrap this one up. So, Jack, can you tell everyone where they can find you?
You can always send me an email at jackm@wdwnt.com.
And Fedra?
You could be my friend on Facebook or follow me on Instagram or send me an email at fedra@wdwnt.com.
Oh, that's good. And you can be my friend on Facebook, too. And also send me an email at joe@wdwnt.com. Check out WDW News Today, Disneyland News Today, as well as Universal Parks News Today for all your Disney Universal news. Finally, if you like our show, enjoy the other WDWNT podcasts, and would like to become a Patreon supporter, please visit the WDWNT Patreon page at www.patreon.com/WDWNT. And with that, this will be the end of WWNT Nerd Alert Season 8, Episode 4. So until next time, see ya.
Good night, all. Be good to each other.
Good night, everyone.